Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and my very own time penalty, it's Dave Vitti.
Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance.
Now, don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. David, Dave, how are we?
I'm very good. Jason, very, very good myself. And in fact, but not looking quite as dapper as you. Look at you. Looking like you've got a new shirt on.
It's not a new shirt, it's an old shirt.
Is it?
But it's one I just saw in the wardrobe this morning and thought, I'm off to a big meeting today.
Okay.
With Adrian Flux, actually.
Oh, really? I wouldn't have mentioned that bit.
No, with the big people. Oh, look, I found this shirt in the wardrobe this morning and thought, that's a belter, and it's in. But the problem is, it's a bit too tight.
Okay.
Because it's a few years old. I've come up with this plan where I just lift that up there.
Yeah.
And no one knows.
Okay, this is very good. I mean, as I say, this is more detail than I was expecting to go into now, but is this something to do with contract renegotiations?
Could well be. Could well be.
Anyway, without further ado, why don't we move on and introduce today's special guest?
Well, today our special guest is one of the brightest young talents in the world of broadcasting. He's a presenter, a commentator, a podcaster, and a voiceover artist. Essentially, he's one of those annoying, talented young guns that's taking jobs away from, well, me and you, Dave. he's annoyingly good.
Yeah.
It is, of course, Formula One commentator, Mr. Harry Benjamin. What about that for an intro, Harry?
Oh, you're too kind, Jason. You're far too kind. I also feel very underdressed now that I've seen what you're wearing.
Good. Good.
it's what he likes to do. It's called a power play, Harry. You know, this is it. He'll say that he's going to be casual and then he'll turn up and sort of blow us both out of the water. But anyway, it's not all about him. Well, not this bit anyway, because thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Harry Benjamin. It's a pleasure to have you on Fueling Around. Let's start with the big issue, the elephant's foot in the room, if you will. Where on earth do you get shoes from when you have size 16 feet? That's what we all want to know.
Yeah. You know what? It's gotten better in these modern times.
Hold on. Stop.
16.
You've got size 16 feet. I've never heard anything like it in my life. That's preposterous.
UK size 16. It can, you know, depending on the type of shoe, it can be one size up, one size down. But more often than not, it's a UK 16. Look, for context, I'm 6'5". I'm a fairly large chap. Mm. But, the feet have always been bloody massive, to be honest. So I remember being 16 years old and having size 16 shoes, and trying to find football shoes when I was at school was an absolute nightmare.
Were you a little bit like those, you know, when you get puppies who are obviously puppies of big dogs, and they go through that phase where actually their feet are far too big for them? Do you know what I mean? you know when that a puppy is going to be a massive dog, and they just have these, they look like they've got someone else's feet. Were you a bit like that as a young boy?
Yeah, often tripping over and falling face first in the playground. That was my general setup. I mean, brilliant talking point. General bane of my life. But I can't go into a store on the high street. Gone are those days.
Have you got these in a 16, please?
Yeah, sometimes it's just quite funny to, if you're bored, go in and ask them. And they'll go, well, check the back, knowing full well they don't stock anything higher than a 12. So I have to go online only to stores. They've all got ridiculous names, like bigshoes.com or higher 90 too big or whatever. And I'm just like, I can't believe I'm having to buy my shoes from these places. I do, thankfully, have American relatives. So I go to America frequently. So when I'm out there, it's a size, they're a size bigger. So I had to get a 17 there.
Wow.
But it's much more normal to go into a shop and you'll see a rack of size 17 shoes. So when I'm there, I'll have to take an extra suitcase so I can bring back a few different styles of shoe. Exactly, load up. So yeah.
Wait, you know what they say, don't they? Big shoes, big socks.
big socks, absolutely. I mean, honestly, Jason, just to put it into context, Harry's kind of got like your feet and my feet together. I mean, I'm about an 8.5. Well, I buy a 9 because it just makes me feel more manly, but essentially I'm about an 8.5.
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you all, but I'm what anywhere between a 40 and a 41, which is about 6 3/4.
Okay. No, that's really. Yeah.
I've got tiny feet. Wow. You know what they say? Tiny feet, small socks.
Thing is, though, I could never have been a racing driver. It just would not have worked. I mean, even in my first ever car, learning how to drive, you know, manual. Like trying to hold the clutch on the bike point while my feet are overlapping on the pedals. Absolute nightmare.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you've got to have tiny feet, haven't you? I mean, do you remember the story with James Hunt?
No.
I mean, this is true. He used to cut the front of the shoe off where his toes were because that extra bit of shoe to go over his toes would he'd foul on the steering column or something like that. So he drove with his toes exposed for most of his career. Wow. Isn't that great?
Every little helps. Yeah. Every little helps.
So anyway, you mentioned racing, Harry. Come on, let's talk F1. Let's talk Saudi. Let's talk, well, first thing.
Are you sure?
First corner. Max was wrong, surely.
Well, I mean, you're the racing driver.
He was
Jason.
Wrong.
He was wrong. I mean, look, I don't think Max was ever going to make that corner. Mm. Oscar Piastri went deep.
Yeah.
But he made the corner and there was still room. And I believe Oscar got to the apex first and had the room and therefore was entitled to the corner.
Yeah.
And I think Max should have actually he would have saved himself so much pain if he'd just given the place back as soon as possible. Because then we had the safety car. He would have been right behind him anyway.
Yeah.
I think, you know, and actually he got given a bit of leniency because normally it would have been a 10-second time penalty. Yeah. But because it was lap one, turn one, got given the 5 seconds. I mean, I don't know about you, but I hate when suddenly we see moments like this and then suddenly we're having to look at the driver guidelines. And I don't know what... I just think, you know, I saw a couple of drivers tweeting their thoughts. And, you know, you look at touring cars or old school DTM or, you know, V8 supercars or whatever. And there's not really necessarily like these kind of guidelines. As if you're side by side, when one overlaps the other... That's their corner. They've got it, you know. Yeah. And then you might have a bit of wheel to wheel, door to door stuff, but you fight for it, and then it's back and forth. I kind of want to get to a stage like that, but I also appreciate Formula One is a bit different, and it's hard to get wheel to wheel now. So when you are there, you kind of have to play by the rules a little bit. I don't know. I just feel like it was a whole mash that didn't need to happen.
I must admit, when I've been in, you know, and I've been in quite a few judicial hearings in my career,
some of them for your racing as well.
I know, it's incredible, isn't it? Fan interference. I mean, what's that about? So, but I used to say, and it took me quite a few years to come up with this analogy, and that is that all the road in front of my car, I own that, because guess what? There's physics involved. Yeah. I'm travelling at 100 mile an hour. So I own all that space in front of my car. Mm. End of. That's it. Mm. And if there's a left-hand corner, I'm on the inside, and you know I've got an overlap. People just need to be grown-up adults and go, well, guess what? I've lost the corner. He's got the inside. He owns that road. I'll yield and I'll have a go again somewhere else. Why can't they just simplify it? Because that makes sense, does it not?
I couldn't agree more. I just think, I mean, we're seeing this more and more, aren't we, in Formula One, particularly around Max Verstappen, and he just... In a way, it's kind of clever because especially last year with Austin and Mexico, where like the whole guidelines thing really reared its head, they're not rules. They're not black and white rules. Mm. They're just guidelines.
Yeah.
And so he is happy and able. And the fact he knows it in his head of where he can position the car to where it's either technically okay or not. And on this occasion, it wasn't. And I think he just kind of has to accept that. I do think fundamentally, to go back to what I said, I think Red Bull made an error in not just giving that place back straight away. The safety car came out. And I think that would have... Because he had decent pace. I think the Red Bull had actually...
He could have won the race.
He could have won. He had better than expected race pace. Yeah. I thought he'd really fall back. But I think he would have been able to keep with Piastri in the nature of Verstappen. And he's got an aggressive driving style. He's happy to get his elbows out. And a circuit like this, where Piastri maybe has the less experience overall, something could have happened there. So I think ultimately, I reckon they're more annoyed the fact that they didn't give the place back initially. And now they're just trying to really hammer home the fact that they don't believe any penalty should have happened. So
is this also related to the circuit itself, in so much as, you know, it's narrow, isn't it? you know, and so therefore you perhaps don't have the same amount of width for those two cars on that particular corner, which therefore means it's not an excuse, but it's perhaps an explanation as to why what happened did happen.
But they know the corners. They know what's coming up. I mean, they're the best drivers in the world, apparently. Mm. Come on, sort yourselves out.
It speaks to a bigger point, I think, that the cars are too big.
That's a very good point.
And, you know, there's all this chatter at the moment about, oh, you know, the new regulations. Should we go back to V10 engines? Should we go back to V8 engines? And if I'm totally honest, I don't care. I don't think I'm going to, because it's completely the wrong way to go. But and it's all just kind of hot air, to be honest. But if anything, why aren't we talking about, you know, going back to that era size of car? That's when I remember just seeing some of the, I mean, even going back to the late, you know, the 2010s, you know, I know they weren't as small as the, you know, the late noughties and the 90s and stuff like that, but even they were better than what we've got now, just in terms of being able to go side by side and wheel to wheel. And if you had that kind of size of car implemented with the new regulations that are coming in, the current copper drivers and the general better racing that we have, you're onto a winner, surely.
Yeah. I would wholeheartedly agree. It never ceases to amaze me. I don't know when the last time you saw a current F1 car was, Dave, but they're monstrously big.
I haven't seen one in the flesh for a long, long time, it has to be said. But, I mean, I know certainly, and we've had this conversation before, haven't we? Remember we had Mark Priestley on last season, and we were talking about Monaco. And obviously, you know, that's a point in question, in so much as the size of the car really, really affects Monaco's legitimacy, I suppose, as even a circuit on the F1 calendar, because of the fact that the circuit is too small for the car, or indeed the car's too large for the circuit.
The problem is, you go from the swing on the pendulum is massive for the Monaco weekend, because in qualifying it's incredible, because the cars are on a knife edge, and they are slightly bigger, you know, the walls and the danger is that much more. But then, once they qualify, well, you kind of know the race order then. Because I dread Grand Prix Sunday in Monaco, because I'm thinking, right, here we go.
Parties to go to, eh?
Oh, yeah. When you've got a bit of a headache come Sunday. But you've got to think of, you know, I do the radio coverage predominantly, so you're talking constantly, and you've got to think, well, if there's nothing happening on track, we've got to keep this show on the road here. So it's, you know, it is going on about all the lovely harbour and the yachts in the harbour and blah blah blah, but that is the general issue. But I mean, Monaco has the history, obviously, but it's the same, like in Saudi, like in even Singapore to points as well. You know, those new street tracks, we are seeing more and more of them come onto the calendar now, and I love a street track, don't get me wrong, but we've got to have the right machinery on them to make it a spectacle. We can't just rely on the nice fireworks and under the lights.
Yeah. Well, talking of which, we've got Miami coming up. Predictions? What do you reckon? Normal state status quo?
I think, well, look, I mean, what's clear from the first five races, five pretty much very different tracks, McLaren have been strong at all of them, and they are a step ahead of the game. Lando Norris took his first win here last year. I think McLaren are going to be strong. I think they are going to be mighty. I think Red Bull are going to struggle with the temperatures in particular, because one of the things that really bites them at the moment is struggling to keep their tyres together when it's so hot. Mm-hmm. That is the big pro that McLaren have at the moment. They just don't seem to chew up their tyres at the moment, as well as having a really well-designed car. So I think McLaren are going to have a step ahead. And then what do you focus on then? I'm still so intrigued by what's going to happen between Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri. I just think, I kind of rub my hands together a little bit. I know you shouldn't, but...
No, you should.
They do seem very friendly, but they're so different. And you have this Oscar Piastri character who's cool as ice. He's got that Aussie accent and he's chill. He's quite likable and he's coming out of his shell, and he's stepped up his game compared to last year.
Big style, hasn't he?
And I love the fact, I don't know if it, I saw this, so I don't, I, but I don't know if it's a true quote that Mark Webber, who obviously manages Piastri, said after Sunday's Grand Prix, 10 points clear in the championship, not bad for a number one driver. And I don't know if that was true or not, but I kind of want it to be true, because I think you've got Webber there in the background. He knows what it's like to be relegated to number two. He's going to make sure his guy doesn't experience what he went through. Then you have Lando Norris, who has all of this talent. But it's so interesting to see that he's not able, seemingly, to be at ease with the speed and the talent that he's got right now. There's always a little something, whether it's not hooking up a lap together in qualifying in Bahrain, crashing out at the crunch moment in Saudi Arabia. Look, every driver will have a crash at some point, mm-hmm. but I think it was because it was off the back of a Bahrain where he was quick, arguably challenging for pole, but something didn't go right when it counted in qualifying. And he's got to stop it. And he's under pressure. And I don't know whether he feels that more.
It's internal pressure he's under. And it's, you know, we spoke about that the other week, didn't we, Dave? And,
yeah.
You know, this is a crucial, I think, being a driver, knowing the psychology and what goes on. You know, you mentioned that they're friendly. They're not.
Mm.
You know, your teammate is your greatest enemy, your greatest rival. And one thing for certain, Oscar is very tasty. He's very, very tasty. And he's cool, calm. Lando's very tasty, but he wears his heart on his sleeve. Mm. And it wouldn't take much, you know, to derail him for Oscar to get a few points up the road. And then the pressure within just start. And we're all human. You know, they're not superhuman, these guys. They have internal angst and problems like we all do. The team have got to come round him, I think, or his management have got to give him a big hug and say, come on, mate, it's all right. Sort yourself out.
This is the question. Can you have two number ones? Can a team treat them equally? When the strategy options become available during a race, you want to be, you know, this is where, for all of Red Bull's faults, at least you know what they're going to do with that second car. You look, Tsunoda gave Verstappen a toe in qualifying for Saudi, which got him pole. Without that, he would have not got pole position.
Sure.
And there was at one point during the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix where Norris was out in front, hadn't pitted, so he shuffled his way to the front. Piastri had pitted, was coming up behind his teammate and was starting to experience that dirty air. Now, what would you normally do? You'd go, Piastri qualified on pole. He is in the main running for this Grand Prix win. But Norris is kind of putting himself in the running for a good recovery. But actually, you'd pit Norris or get him out of the way to allow Piastri the free air. They didn't do that immediately because they've got two number one drivers that they're trying to be as even with as possible. But I don't think that can last.
Well, there's a thing called a contract, isn't there?
Yeah, there is also that.
They've both got contracts, and it depends what's in it. However, it can work, two number ones, but there will be fireworks.
Mm.
And there'll be fireworks within the team, and it could break down.
Do you think, Jason, you know, from with your, obviously, you're with your driver's head on, do you think that their contracts could suggest that they are both number ones, or do you think that there is a one and two situation in there?
I don't think there's a one or two, and I don't think there's even a you are a number one.
Right.
The contracts will just be...
You're a driver for our team.
Mentioned. Yeah. But there's a catch-all clause in all contracts which basically states if an instruction is given by the team principal, you do what we say. Because guess what? You're an employee.
Yeah.
You're employed. We pay you to do a job. So, you know, and they'll both be fighting. Webber will be behind the scenes, you know, doing his magic. It's what makes motor racing exciting. You know, think of Prost and Senna and McLaren. Oh, my God, there was fireworks.
I tell you what, listening to Oscar's chat on the team radio following the win, and I don't know enough about him, whether this is just what he's like generally or whether this was all sort of good PR, but he was very, very gracious towards, it was all about us and the team and well done, everybody. And he was almost not quite self-deprecating, but he was very much, you know, this was us. This wasn't me, you know,
that's all part of the plan, mate. It's all
playing the game beautifully.
Absolutely strategy.
Yeah.
You know, and it's great to see. It's great.
I do generally think that Oscar is more down to earth than Lando is. Maybe it's because Oscar has less experience of being a Formula One driver. Mm-hmm. And Norris very much is in the limelight. You know, he is the one that's going to make the headline in the Sun, in the Mirror, in all those tabloid newspapers. And I think Oscar Piastri knows that and is quite happy to let Lando have that, take the limelight. And Oscar just goes about... does his thing. I can absolutely see Mark Webber in the background just being like, mate, head down, get on with the job.
Yeah.
You know you're quick and you're going to win the championship. Yeah. Easy does it. You don't need to get spoiled in off-track politics. I think even down to their, you know, Oscar Piastri's in a long-term relationship too. He's been with the same girlfriend since he was at school. You know, it's all these kind of things which I think keep him really
stability,
nice and level-headed.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think that will provide the edge.
That's where I think I would have gone wrong, you know, if I'd been in Formula One. So I wouldn't have had a girlfriend.
And you wouldn't have been the only one.
No, I would have just been in the wind tunnel doing aero testing on my schnozzer. Have you thought about having it at the front of the car like that?
I mean, yeah, forget about little feet. I mean, you've got a whole new advantage situation there, haven't you?
Mate, I couldn't find face masks which worked on me.
So, to be fair, same, to be fair. But mine's a bit more in proportion, so...
Oh, thanks.
Before we leave the F1 current circuit, just give us your prediction for top three for Miami, please, Mr. Benjamin, if you will.
I'm going to go for Piastri to win again. I'm going to go Norris second.
Okay.
Okay.
And then we're going to go for... Oh, it's going to be boring. I'm going to go for Max Verstappen third. Yeah, that's so it's a bit boring that, but I don't think it will be boring. But as predictions go, that's my 1, 2, 3.
Works for me.
Does work for me. So anyway, let's go back to the beginning of the story. I mean, you've worked in the industry for what, the past 10 years or something like that? And essentially from school, from what I can gather, you got into, you know, lots of production experience behind the scenes.
Yeah, yeah.
But how on earth do you transfer? How does that transfer into becoming, you know, a lead commentator on the BBC or Sky? I mean, how does that work?
I ain't got a clue, mate. Just happens. Hang on, let me just get my LinkedIn up so I can remember what I think. God, when you said 10 years, I was like, no, it's only been a couple. But actually, it is about 10 years. I'm 20, how old am I now? 28.
Same as me.
Yeah. 32 here.
Couple of
Jace has always been a little bit older than us, Harry.
Yeah.
If it helps, I've got a fair bit of grey hair coming in and have
done.
You've got
more than me, actually, in
fairness. Harry, can I just put you straight? Never call it grey. It's silver. Okay?
Sterling. Silver. I thought it was silver. Sterling.
It can be sterling, yes. Sterling. Or chromium.
Oh, very nice. Okay, I'll go with that. I'll go with that. It's all that wisdom. But, I suppose I first started in it, like properly pursuing it and knowing that I kind of wanted to be in motorsport in some form when I was 17 years old. I was at school when I started doing a blog just online because school said it would look good for our university applications if we had some extracurricular stuff going on. So I started a blog. I think I called it Motorsport Talks, and I just started writing about F1 to begin with. Mm-hmm. But like all like the really niche underdog stories. I was like, there's no point in writing about who's winning because everyone does that. Yeah. So I'm going to write about the battle for 10th or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And I quite enjoyed that. And then that got me into looking at other motorsports. I was like, well, if I actually want to be in Formula One, I was like, it's never going to happen. And it was still Bernie Eccleston era. And I was like, I have no ins. I don't even know where you begin with this.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I thought, well, let's see what other motorsport there is out there. And this thing called Formula E had just started.
Yeah.
And I watched the first season of that on ITV, and I just watched it, and I thought, oh, this is perfect because they'll be looking for people, like to there'll be opportunities here. And I would watch the first season, and I wait for the credits to come up at the end to see who all the producers were, and basically found an email address of the company that produced it, and started haranguing them basically over the course of I was 18 and revising, or 17, 18, while I was revising for my A-levels. I was sending emails off to this production company saying, hi, these are my predicted A-level grades, as if that was going to be the real clincher. And do you have any like work experience? Could I come up to Donington Park and just like wander around and help the camera operators and just see how a pit lane worked and what it all was? And eventually they said, yeah, come on up. So I had to get myself there and drove up and spent a day with the team, and I met the pit reporter, Nikki Shields, and just helped her a bit. I made coffee, and that was probably that was my first bit of motorsport experience ever, sort of
brilliant,
17
brilliant.
Going on 18. And since then, that's kind of what I've done. I just kept on being in as many different places as possible, hoping that one day there would be an opportunity. And I did go up that route of being a work experience kid. Then I got a job being a runner and an intern and all that kind of stuff. And all while kind of studying, actually. I went to drama school initially because I was also trying to be an actor too. This is where it goes a bit weird. I was also trying to be an actor and balancing the both. And then I went to university, did 3 years of a drama degree whilst also doing things like student radio, a motorsport podcast. And that's kind of how it all really began to develop once I started getting proper kind of broadcast experience. Student radio is one of the best things. If anybody stumbles upon this and is, I get asked all the time, you know, where do you start? How do you even get into this world anymore? And it is really difficult. But if you are lucky enough to be able to go to university, student radio is so brilliant in finding you contacts and opportunities. But even if you're not at university, they're getting less and less now, local radio, but there are still some community stations and things like that. And I just think, regardless of whatever you go into, whether that be motorsport, football, or not even in sports broadcasting, radio is such a brilliant place to begin and learn. So that was the kind of initial beginnings. That kind of covers sort of 17 to 21, really. And then COVID.
So was COVID there for... without being too flippant about it, was COVID good for your career or bad for your career?
I think it was good. I mean, I graduated university in the pandemic. So I sort of submitted my dissertation from home and that was it. And I was like, oh, that's a bit underwhelming, isn't it? And then I was doing a kind of podcast with a mate, and it was just interviewing drivers, team principals, notable people from various paddocks, just about their lives, their life and career and stories. And that was going quite well because suddenly no one had any excuse to be busy anymore. So they were just like, yeah, here's a Zoom link, let's chat. And so we get David Coulthard on, and he's just there sat in, he has like a sort of throne that it feels like when you interview him online.
Hey, he does.
Yeah. And so, but again, he was lovely. And we had people like Crofty and Eddie Jordan and, you know, all these, Mario Andretti and all these people. And I'm just sat in my bedroom cupboard, like interviewing these guys. And I'm just thinking, bloody hell. And that was, I mean, it wasn't, you know, I wasn't being paid. It was just something to do, to be honest. And then that lasted for, well, pretty much a year of COVID. And then during that same period, I got an email address for somebody who worked at Formula One Management who do all the broadcast stuff for F1. And I just emailed them and I said, here is my, I had cobbled together a showreel.
Yeah.
And I said, look, I'm 21 or whatever I was, and I'm looking for, I want to get into motorsport, and do you, you know, is there any experience or opportunities, or can I come and shadow and just see how it all operates? And not really expecting to hear anything back. And then, 2 days later, I got an email back from the head of broadcast who said, oh, can we have a video call? And I was like, okay, sure. So suddenly I find myself on this Teams call with like the head of broadcast of Formula One and an exec producer. And I'm just sat there like, oh, hi, I love Formula One. And they went, can you commentate? And I went, yeah, sure.
Of course, yeah.
Having figure it out afterwards.
Precisely. Having never commentated before in my life, I'd done a lot of presenting and a lot of general broadcasting, but I had never commentated. In fact, I had ruled it out because I would listen and watch Crofty and Ben Edwards and whoever else. And I would think, how on earth are they doing that? A, how are they talking through lap one? B, when is a red flag? What on earth are they saying? I used to wonder how on earth they come up with things to talk about in a 2-hour practice session. Mm. And I just think, oh, I just thought, no, I'll do the bits around it. And that'll be nice. And anyway, though, I said yes. And then I didn't hear anything for ages. And then I got invited to Biggin Hill, which is where Formula One headquarters is based. And it was 2020, must be 2020 at this stage, because it was still a pandemic. And it was the Sakhir Grand Prix weekend where Romain Grosjean had that huge crash. And I was there in the gallery watching it all. And it was incredible because you saw every angle. They had every onboard going and every CCTV image. You were seeing it. It, you know, whereas the cameras on the world feed obviously cut away, we're seeing it in full. And actually, it was incredible to see this team of people react and respond to something like that. I don't think they get enough credit. They get a lot of people having a go at them, but I actually think what they did was amazing and how they handled all that, because at one point you did not know if he was alive or not. That was a long afternoon at Biggin Hill. And I left there and I would keep emailing, but nothing was really coming through. And then they had a support category commentator, Alex, who had been doing Porsche Super Cup, and he was not doing that anymore, and he was doing F2 and F1 TV and F3, And I quickly then I thought, oh, maybe there's, and they did this big announcement about it, and I thought, oh, there's an opportunity here. So I ripped some Porsche Supercut races off YouTube and just did a bit of commentary, literally as I am right now. I think with this actual microphone and just watching, I watched a few laps and then tried to do it. I couldn't do a full lap. I was running out of breath. I didn't know who the drivers were. Thankfully, with Supercut, they write their names in big letters on the windscreen. Quids in. There we go. At least I've got something going here. And I just basically managed to cobble something together that was about 3 minutes long, too long. Sent it off. And it was okay. And then 4 months after that, I get a phone call whilst I'm in the shower. It's a FaceTime phone call as well. And bearing in mind, it's like 8:45 in the morning here. So, you know, I'm not quite, and I've just graduated university. It's COVID. I'm not, you know, that's early for me.
Yeah. And plus, so, it's going to take you an hour to wash those feet anyway, isn't it?
Yeah. I see my phone going off. I see it going off. I mean, listening to music, I've taken it into the shower with me. And I see who it is. And I go, oh my God, run out of the shower. Try and like get a towel on, dry off as quick as possible. But I don't want to obviously answer it straight away, so it looks like I got out of the shower. So no. I take it, ran into my bedroom, sat down, and I was like, oh, I need to put something over my chest. Quickly got like my pajama top on, tried to sort of do my hair a bit. And then just as I'm about to answer the phone call, it rings off. And I go, oh, God, why? And then you're thinking, why is this person ringing me? Why are they FaceTime calling me at 8:45 on a Tuesday, you know? Then the lady messages me and goes, sorry, I missed you. And I went, oh, no, I'm around now, sorry. And then she ran me back, and it was still a video call. So I was still sat there at a desk where I had my pajama top on and just a towel on underneath, having ran out of the shower to answer this phone call from Formula One. And she basically said, oh, we'd love to offer you the commentary for Porsche Supercup.
Wow.
And I was like, yeah, great. Absolutely. Sure. 100%. I'm in. Mm. And I just thought that because that was the opportunity, that was the door opening. And I just took it with both hands and didn't ask too many questions and went straight through. And then 3 months later, the first race was Monaco, and it was on the support category, and you're embedded. I did it from Biggin Hill, and you're embedded with the F1 team. And you know, I was alongside Sean Hollenby, who was my co-commentator, who I'd never met before.
No way.
And so I don't think he'd obviously done a bit of broadcasting before. I had never done any commentary. Neither of us had really done Porsche Supercup. So, you know, lights out, and we're off down to turn one in Monaco with 28 Porsche Supercup drivers. And that was my first proper commentary, really. And I was in.
Do you know what? I just let me butt in here if I may. Mate, can I just say, and I know that, you know, I know that Dave feels the same way. Can I just say, Harry, mate, I like the cut of your jib. You've done a brilliant job. No, but generally, you've done a fantastic. I love people who get out there and go and make things happen. Yeah. And you've done that. So massive round of applause, mate. You should be very proud of yourself because you're a great broadcaster. And I say that because it's true.
Thank you.
I wholeheartedly agree. And I think the other thing as well, that your story demonstrates better than anyone else that I've met, you know, in recent time, is the fact that because people do ask Jason, they ask me, you know, sort of, listen, we're slightly older than you, you know, but they'll sort of give, you know, they'll sort of ask, oh, how do I do this? Or how do I get into this? Or who should I speak to, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a really fine balancing act that you have to do, which I, from your story and you know, the little that I know of you already, is you seem to have done it beautifully, because it's about being persistent and having enough about you, but you can't be too persistent and be that person whereby the phone will ring and they're kind of go, oh my God, it's that Harry kid again, you know, he's ringing, you know, and it's a really difficult one to judge how you get it right. And I think you have got it just right. I think also, ultimately, it's about being a good person, good at what you do, being keen, but also being someone that is likable around the team. And, you know, especially working with the likes of Nicky Shields is lovely, you know. And so what a great person for you to actually work with alongside and learn a bit and almost be her understudy to a certain extent. But I think you've played it perfectly, you know, and you're now getting the rewards that you fully deserve.
Oh, thank you. That means a great deal. And actually, well, you mentioned Nikki there. You know, she did a lot for me. She probably doesn't realize she did, but she was she replied to my emailing, and yeah. she was the only person I knew in motorsport broadcasting to begin with, and I wanted to kind of do what she was doing. And I was also quite interested in Formula E, and it was new, it was electric, it was, you know, technical, and I thought, oh, maybe this is the future. And she just kind of helped me, and I ended up kind of forming a relationship with her, and she was kind of mentoring me through. If I ever had a problem, she'd give me her advice, and I would also do some work for her as well and help her, and that would help me in the long run, because I'd be figuring out how to prep for a race weekend by helping her. So she did a lot for me, and we're still good friends to this day as well. So yeah, I mean, look, I've had a lot of help. I will always, you know, there's so many people who have given me advice along the way, but you know, I have always been that guy where I think, you know, I would set a reminder in my calendar if I hadn't heard back from somebody within 2 weeks.
Try them again.
I think Tuesday at 10 a.m. is a good time to send an email. Apparently, don't know
why. Write
that
down.
Yeah, I just decided, because I just think, well, Monday, everyone's going to be, no one likes a Monday if you're in the office. And also, you probably got a load of emails that you ignored from the Friday. So then if you do Tuesday at 10, sort of mid-morning, having a coffee, sitting down, oh, whose name pops to the top of the inbox? It's hopefully mine. So that was my kind of mentality, at least. So, yeah. But look, I mean, look, I've gone all around the houses to get to where I am, I suppose. And I still did not think I'd be a Formula One commentator, because there was a moment, what, a couple of years ago, where I didn't really see where the progression would be, because I did Porsche Super Cup, and then that led to Formula 3. And those opportunities all came about because I was sort of in the Formula One family now. I was literally in the building. Yeah. So then it was just trying to kind of knock down on doors. And one thing, I suppose, that came back around was my first Five Live opportunity, where this is a bizarre story, actually. So I was doing I think it's the 8 hours of Kyalami, which an intercontinental GT race. I wasn't in Kyalami. I was in Droitwich near Birmingham.
just to the north of Kyalami.
Yes. Just off in an industrial estate, just off the roundabout. Yeah. And I was doing the commentary. It was, again, one of my early ones. And actually, Ben Edwards had put me forward for it, because I didn't know Ben very well, but he was seeing what I was doing, and he couldn't. He was supposed to do it. He couldn't do it for whatever reason, and suggested me. So they got in touch with me, and it was a guy called Richard Hay who ran Hay Fisher TV, and I met him. Nicky Shields got me an interview, a meeting with him when I was 18 years old. So I was not a stranger to Droitwich, but we're now, you know, 5 years on, 5 years on from that interview, and I'd not really spoken much to Richard since then. In fact, I was deathly afraid of the man. He had scared the living daylights out of me when I first met him. You know, he was the reason I subscribed to Motorsport magazine and started getting the hard copies delivered to my house, because he was like, if you want to be serious, that's what you need to do. And I was like, oh my God, I don't think I'm cut out for this, but I tried. And anyway, fast forward 5 years, I'm now the sort of the relief commentator for Bruce Jones and John Watson. And I'm just sitting here thinking, like, can't believe I'm next to John Watson. And I knew Bruce as well, who was a very good broadcaster, a very funny man. And so we
also
do this.
Also has big feet.
Also, yes, another tall man as well. Yeah, we do Goodwood together. So it's always quite, you know, nice to share those. And anyway, we did this race, and, you know, it was fine. And I'm sat in the car park, and we're all in the same hotel. So we're going back to meet the guys. I'm going back to have dinner with John Watson. And I'm sat in the car, and just about to go, and then I get a call from an unknown number, and I answer it, and it's the head of IMG, who produce BBC Radio 5 Live's coverage. And he says, look, they need a commentator to cover for a couple of races this year, because Jack, who was doing the commentary, was doing Formula E. And so they said, oh, we found out about you because one of our old producers mentioned your name, and now you're doing commentary. And we know you used to be an intern for Five Live, and, you know, wanted to do all this kind of stuff. And we've just seen you're doing Porsche and things like that. So would you like to do the Australian Grand Prix for us, for the BBC? And I'm like, sat in my car trying to play it uber
cool. Play it cool, Rodney. Play it cool.
Exactly. And, you know, John Watson's just steamed out of the car park in his Mercedes, and I'm there like about to scream in my Nissan Qashqai and just going, oh my God. So that had come about because when I was 21 or whatever, I did a 1 month internship at a production company who had the rights to do 5 live F1. Mm-hmm. And I got paid £100 a week, which I thought was amazing.
Yeah.
And covered my travel, got me lunch. And I was the general dog's body there, and I applied for that internship because they did F1, but they also did stuff like the Olivier Awards for mm-hmm. magic yeah. and all this kind of thing. So I got to do loads of different stuff, but the F1 was the one I was really interested for. And so that moment had come back, you know, 5-6 years later to then get my first F1 commentary opportunity, which was 2022 Australian Grand Prix. So it you know, there's a lot of people I met along the way, and I hopped really around the houses, but it did all come back around, and it did all tie in again. So, you know, that is when persistence pays off, but not too much persisting.
It's a great story, Harry. There's so much to it. Before we go into the ins and outs of commentating, because I think it's a fascinating area, I've got a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping to do. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Nice housekeeping.
Thank you.
Nice housekeeping. So anyway, the nuts and bolts of commentary. I know how it works. I can't do it. I mean, I've never tried, but I mean, it's difficult. But I've worked with Ben Edwards, who you know, mm-hmm. and he's he's a real pro, isn't he?
Yeah.
But one thing which strikes me when I've gone to the commentary booth at, say, Goodwood, which I think probably is the hardest of all, because you've got all these wacky cars, all these drivers you've never really heard of, and those who you have. I mean, obviously you mentioned Nicky, so some people, Nicky Shields, you've obviously got some help along the way, but how big is your race folder? Because obviously you've got to have one of those, haven't you?
Yeah, and I've got many different ones. The Goodwood one, Goodwood is the heart. I've had some clangers at Goodwood. That is a tough one to keep a hold of. But obviously the main folder is now F1.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a full binder, you know, the way I describe it is you're just constantly revising for an exam, it feels like. And you know, it's an exam where you're allowed your notes, but obviously you can't be looking down and reading things as the cars are going by, because F1, you'll miss something minute and that'll be major for the race or something like that. So that's how I describe it, and I've gotten to a good place with it now. I think when I first started, I didn't really know what I was doing. It took me a while to figure out how to actually prepare for a race. So now,
and did you figure that out yourself, or did you have a bit of help?
I think I generally figured it out by myself. And then, you know, I would work with other co-commentators and other commentators, and I would see what they were doing and you know, to kind of go, well, that's quite a good way of doing that. Or mm-hmm. equally, just by doing the actual commentary, I realized where the gaps were in my own knowledge and where I needed to you know, revise, basically. Mm-hmm. And that helped just by doing some, like, you know, I used to do like a series called Euro Formula Open, and that was quite good because not many people watched it, so I could get away with making a lot of mistakes, but it made me up my game in terms of how I prepare and things like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, now the nuts and bolts of it are my track map. I love doing my track map. I always print that off, and I scribble on it because I just think, especially, again, I primarily do it for a radio audience. It's so great to be able to go off on a tangent sometimes in a practice session, whatever. And if there's an interesting story about a particular corner or why it's called this, or, you know, the speeds they're traveling, and you're really trying to put the listener in the cockpit of a Formula One car and take them to Miami or wherever it might be. So that is a real kind of must. And I even used to, I don't do it so much anymore, but I would also play the F1 game and do laps around that track just so I knew.
That's interesting.
So, especially, talk about Saudi Arabia and these street tracks. It's so hard actually to recognize where the cars are on the track sometimes. So you've got to try and find little ways of doing it. And I was talking to Sam Bird, who is McLaren's Formula E driver. He was doing the commentary with me for the Saudi Arabian weekend. And he was saying how the drivers look at the sponsorship boards and the different colours that they change to. He's like, we know it's turn 14 when it goes from this sponsor to that sponsor or whatever. And I'm like, that's so interesting. So that's quite a good, I think I might start doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's one thing. And then, I mean, that's kind of what I have. I have a lot of stuff in front of me, but I've got my track map, and I've got a double-sided page of every driver and all the teams, and just, you know, little facts in terms of like what's their best ever qualifying and their best ever race here, where did they finish last week, but then also just some general kind of like talking points and things that I've seen from the week, you know, if it's something just to remind myself that Antonelli said that he's still got a maths exam to do or whatever, you know, quick glance down and go, oh yeah, you know, if we need a little bit of a fun talking point or something. So it's stuff like that. And then I've got like the kind of the stuff that stays the same and is just stats and facts. So that could be, you know, how many podiums, all-time career podiums, all that kind of stuff. And then general kind of, I call it red flag filler, which I go off and make, which is interesting, fun facts about the country we're in, iconic moments from previous Grand Prix there, and just general kind of like, I also do a whole thing about other sports in that country because sometimes, because we're on Five Live, we're catering to a general sports enthusiast as well as the F1 fan.
They're not necessarily F1 fanatics, are they?
Exactly. So it's quite nice sometimes if we end up talking about football, and look, I'm no expert in football, but you know, I've got something fun up my sleeve about the football scene in Saudi Arabia or whatever it might be. But or even it's quite interesting. We were on Five Sports Extra for the Saudi Grand Prix, so you have to do updates into Five Live, which is a whole technical thing that not a lot of people understand because why would you? We don't really publicize it, but there's stuff like that that fascinates me and why I love broadcasting in general. So you kind of have to stop commentating live while the race is still going. You're hearing whatever's going on the main station on BBC Radio 5 Live, and at that time of the night, it was 6:06 with Robbie Savage. And he's talking, and then he's like, right, okay, let's get an update from the Formula One with Harry. And so I'll give them a 30-second update, which people will hear only as a 30-second update on the main station, but the ones who are listening on Five Sports Extra, well, they'll be hearing me stop talking for a while and then do a 30-second update and then continue picking back up. But the audience who are listening on Five Sports Extra understand that that's what's going on, so they let you get away with it. But we had an interesting moment where Robbie Savage asked a follow-up question to my 30-second update because he was clearly quite engrossed in the F1. He was like, why has Max got a 5-second time penalty? Like, I don't understand it. So I suddenly got to give him an answer to follow back up.
And so I had great fun.
Great fun. And then I sort of had to let them go, and then you have to go back to on Five Sports Extra and sort of go, well, we weren't expecting a follow-up from Robbie Savage there, but there we go. We're back now with the racing action, by the way. So here's what's happening. So it's little moments like that.
All the little corners you've looked at to try and find some interest about them, did you find any good stuff?
What for the Saudi Arabian one?
No, I'm saying, you know, when you're doing your research, you're looking at all the different corners around the world and stuff. So here's a start for 10. Alton Park, Knickerbrook. Now, there is a story behind that, and it does involve knickers.
I think I know that story.
Do you?
But I can't. No, you're going to be better at telling me, because I think I've only ever done one race at Alton Park, which I did Ferrari Challenge for a year. And Ferrari Challenge UK, and they raced at Alton Park. But this is poor podcasting because I've forgotten the story. But did somebody stumble across someone having an interesting time? Is that the general gist of it?
Way back in the day when it was a country park in the big mansion, there was a canoodling couple in there which were caught by the gamekeeper or the landowner or something, and they ran off. And in that little brook, there was a pair of knickers hung up on a tree.
Yes.
Or caught in a tree or something like that. Isn't that great?
And that's why it's always been Knickerbrook to this day.
Knickerbrook to this day. Isn't that great?
Harry, you know when you're doing your prep and obviously the folder that you talk about, which is, you know, every commentator must have their own system, if you like. You know, I'd imagine that your system and your folder is totally different to that of Ben Edwards and Crofty and so on and so forth, because it needs to work for you. But just hearing you talk then about doing the Five Live stuff. Does the preparation for radio, or indeed the way that you commentate for radio, differ hugely to TV? You know, I mean, as I suppose because of the obvious, because, you know, they haven't got the pictures that you're seeing on the television, therefore you've got to explain it differently.
I think the basic crux is obviously the same, because you're telling the story of the race and what's happening. So you will follow the main story of the race. But where it differs is, when I first started on Five Live, I would write down ways of describing things because in the heat of the moment, you fluff your words and you say rubbish things. So even when it comes down to constantly hitting home that it's the Papaya McLaren, or I was like, how do I describe the green Sauber? And it's like, it's a fluoro green Sauber. Or even just really making sure that I can set the scene for where we're at, which is, you know, Saudi Arabia just gone, let's say, you know, we're on the shores of the Red Sea. Mm. We're, you know, an hour's drive from Riyadh, the capital, southwest.
A bit and, more detail.
You know, the lights have lit up this 27 corner track, and you know, against pitched against the night of the black sky, all that kind of stuff. And so that you wouldn't say all that on Sky, just wouldn't, because people can see that.
Yeah.
You might add in a little bit just to give it a little bit of drama, but in general, it's say what you see and allow the coverage to breathe on the TV. Whereas in the radio, you can't really stop for too long because then there's nothing. You've got to think people are listening to this in their cars, they're switching on in their kitchens while they're making a cup of coffee or whatever. So you've got to think, okay, you've got to constantly fill the gaps, but also you're constantly telling them about the time, what's going on. Okay, by the way, it's lap 7. Verstappen leads, Piastri, Norris. Mm. That's the top 10. That's the top 15. And we've lost two drivers. Whereas you're not constantly rejigging the timing tower on Sky, for instance, because it's there for everybody to see. So those are the two differences, and that's something I struggled to adapt with initially, and will probably have to get my head around it again when I...
With that in mind then, Harry, do you think that the way that you speak, or indeed the pace of your delivery, I'm just thinking about questions as you're describing it, stuff that I hadn't thought about before, but do you think that the pace of your delivery on radio is different to that on the TV? And by that I mean, going back to your point about needing to fill all of those gaps and talking around it, and here we are looking at the sun setting, you know, over the black sky here in Jeddah and blah-de-blah-de-blah. Do you think that there is a bit of that or not?
I think so. I mean, I probably... look, I mean, Formula One commentators are always accused of talking too much, aren't they, and talking too quickly. I think there's definitely times where my pace is probably quicker on the radio, actually, than it is on the
really?
TV. But then sometimes where you can get away with more on the radio because something could have just happened and you can kind of say it's happening as you're calling on the TV, you might be in the middle of a conversation and suddenly there's a dart to the inside and Norris is trying one on Hamilton and you've got to kind of stop yourself mid-sentence and go, oh, but there's a move going on there. Whereas in radio, if it was an important move for the lead or something, you would stop yourself. But if you're kind of just finishing a point on something else, you can get to the end of that point and then go, by the way, Hamilton's just trying to move on, blah, blah, blah. So there's little nuances. Radio, you can generally get away with a lot more, in my opinion, than TV.
Yeah. So I've got a quickie question. Is Lando happy that you've got Piastri's name on your wall?
It says pastry, but I...
sorry.
Did you read that as Danish Piastri?
Danish Piastri, yeah.
It says pastry, I promise you. But I have done a couple of videos in front of it and I've looked at it and gone, oh God, that does look a bit like Piastri.
You know what? with my eyes, and they're not the best nowadays, it does look... But I'm now going to call him on the TV when I'm shouting... I'm going to call it pastry from now on.
It doesn't help. It's a bit orange as well.
So, right. Before we wrap up here, Harry, because we're going to have to let you go in a second. Back to the dream job, back to the commentating, you know, all of this work to get to this position where you are now. And it must be a pinch yourself position.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is the beginning of what we hope is going to be a long career in this game. You're still a young man. I mean, we want to be hearing you broadcasting in the next 20 and 30 years at least.
You'll be regretting saying that.
Well, yeah. You know, this is what we say at this moment in time, at least anyway. But so far, what's been the craziest moment that's happened to you as part of this big traveling worldwide F1 circus?
That's a belter question,
oh,
Dave.
Oh, God. Oh, what's the craziest moment that's happened? You know what? Being an F1 commentator in the first place was crazy. Getting the call to do Sky Sports was crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a big moment for me and completely unexpected. But the moment actually was after my first race for Sky, which was Imola last year. I then rock up in Monaco the week after with the BBC team. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's crazy that I can just say I rocked up in Monaco. But anyway, and I'm walking down the paddock, and I still think nobody knows who I am, really. You know, I'm just I could be anyone. And I'm walking past George Russell, and I'm with actually Jenny Gow, and we stop for a little conversation, and I've not met George properly before, and Jenny sort of goes to introduce me, and then George knows who I am. And I'm like, oh, brilliant. My God. He was like, oh, you did the commentary last week, didn't you? And I went, yeah. And he went, oh, good job, man. How was it? And I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And then we have a conversation. He's really lovely and a proper gent. Yeah. And then we walk a little bit further down. And Lance Stroll and his team are walking the opposite way. And I give him a sort of smile. And I walk past him. Then he stops, turns around and goes, oh, hey, man. You did the commentary last week, didn't you? Yeah, it was really good. And I was like, what is happening right now? Like two F1 drivers on the trot while I'm just walking down the paddock are going, like, they know who I am and they're saying, like, well done. And sorry for that, sounds like massively inflating my ego there. But that for me was just, I was like, can't believe Lance Stroll just stopped at his tracks and turned around, of all the people. But that was a bizarre moment.
Yeah, as I say, please don't apologise for the clang, because that's exactly the question I asked. You know, it's those sort of moments where you kind of think, wow.
Great to hear, isn't it?
It's
great to hear that they mean so much, those little moments, which are breathtaking,
They're nothing for them, but they mean a lot for me. And even just one other thing. I mean, the small thing, I was we've got Damon Hill joining us in the commentary booth for a couple of races this week. And I've met Damon a couple of times. And
he hasn't
done radio commentary before, though. So I thought I'd just send him a WhatsApp. I was sat at my kitchen table opposite my brother and I WhatsApped Damon. And I said, look, if you want to meet up for a coffee or something beforehand, just have a chat things through. And I sent that message just on my laptop doing a bit of work. My brother's opposite me, and suddenly I get a call, and I got to answer it. I go, hi Damon, you're right? And then I realized my brother just looked up and he went, is that Damon here? And so I'm just like, I didn't quite clock the ridiculousness of, oh, Damon Hill's just calling me on my phone, I better answer that. Having a quick conversation with Damon Hill to sort out when we're going to meet for a coffee. It's moments like that for the 17-year-old who liked Formula One on the telly and began writing a blog about it at school, to then being the coffee boy or whatever, to that. That's what highlights how crazy it's been, to be honest.
No, it's great to see, and you know, thoroughly deserved. And Harry, continued success in all that you do.
Yes.
We will chart your career with what's the word? We'll chart it
with Danish pastries.
Danish pastries and
shoes.
And bigger.
Shoes galore.
And you know what? On that slightly shambolic note, I think you need to take us out, Jason.
Well, that is it for this week's Fueling Round, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, thank you very much. But a huge thanks to our special guest this week, the one and only Mr. Harry Benjamin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Harry. It's been a pleasure. Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Thanks for listening, peeps. And, well, we'll see you next time. Ta-da.